Well, good morning, Menlo Church. It's very good to see you, and I want to welcome all of you at all of our campuses and those of you joining us online. It's good to be together. And just to reiterate, I want to say thank you for all of you who served and were part of last weekend, Make Your City Great. It was just an amazing time. And I want to say a special thank you to those of you who led a project. This church is built on the kind of blood, sweat, and tears of our leaders, and you guys just did an amazing, amazing, amazing job. And some of you served for the first time. For the first time, you jumped in and saw one of the projects, one of the ministry partners that we work with, and I want to encourage you to not make that the only time, not make the first time the only time, but to continue to find a way to pour out your inner investment into what's going on in the communities around the Bay Area, because that's what we're here for. And some of you may have been part of our church for the first time. Maybe someone brought you to Make Your City Great. You're not really sure about faith or the church, and now you're here to kind of figure out, well, what's this place all about? And we are so glad you're here. We hope you enjoy your time with us. I'm only going to speak for 3 or 4 hours, so hopefully that will be all right. We're picking up our series, The Confidence Paradox, about a man in the scriptures, a man in the Bible named Jacob. And we've been on this roller coaster ride with Jacob. Jacob's name means to deceive, to grab, to manipulate. And Jacob is in basically lying and cheating and stealing his way to building a successful life. He tricked his brother out of his family birthright, 2/3 of the family wealth. And he tricked his father into receiving the family blessing. And he ran away from home and built a life, a family, prosperity, wealth, material success, far from home. And we're kind of seeing that Jacob has really built the life that many of us are looking for. He has what many of you want. Great reputation, great resume, great success, great stuff. But beneath that, underneath that, in the quiet of his heart, there's this battle going on. There's this struggle that he will confront in the story we're going to see today that I think may shed light. I hope will shed some light on some struggles that you may be facing and what may be at work in those. So there's a fair bit of context to setting up this story, so I'm going to walk through a few details and some passages to get us ready. And just bear with me, and I may pause and ask, are you with me? And even though you're in church, I want you to just lie boldly and say yes, okay? Are you with me? All right, so we pick up Jacob. He's away living with his uncle Laban. And he's doing what Jacob always does. He's kind of scheming and tricking and doing all that stuff. And he basically deceives his uncle into giving him kind of the best livestock, the best of his herds. And he hears these rumors that his life may be in danger. It's kind of the same thing that happened before. And so he thinks, where can I go? Well, the one place he can go is the one place he doesn't want to go. It's home. To the place, more specifically, the person that he's been avoiding his whole life, his brother Esau. What will Esau think? What will happen when he arrives home? And so Jacob begins to prepare for this. Listen to what he does. He sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau and the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, this is what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob, he's always kind of playing the language here. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. Now I am sending this message to my Lord that I might find favor in your eyes. Jacob is already working his brother. He's already going after him. Let's kind of unpack this language. He says this, I've been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. In other words, I'm not hiding. I'm not running. I'm not afraid. I haven't been, you know, I'm just kind of living with my uncle Laban. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. In other words, I'm not here to steal from you. I'm not here to take anything from you. I'm not here to trick you. And then I love this. Now I'm sending this message to my Lord that I might find favor in your eyes. In other words, why don't we just let the past be the past? Let's let bygones be bygones. Let's just move on and forget that anything else ever happened. Are you with me? You see what he's doing? All right. Now the messenger goes to Esau and he gives this message. And then he comes back and he reports to Jacob that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. Imagine that. No, how you doing? No, welcome home. No, it's going to be great to see you. No, you know, we're going to have a big meal, a big party. He comes out literally with an army. What a show of force. And so Jacob just begins to panic even more. And so he sends this extravagant gift to his brother Esau of goats and sheep and camels and cows and donkeys. But again, he's trying and planning and scheming away. He kind of does it in a certain way. Listen to what he does. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, go ahead of me. In other words, I'm going to stay back in the back and keep some space between the herds. Now, why does he do that? Well, Jacob is thinking ahead. Jacob realizes with each group, with each gift that he sends, Esau will have to be preparing as if that's Jacob, preparing as if this could be the battle. And with each group, after he prepares, there'll be a new influx of people and livestock and stuff to manage, which basically weakens Esau's ability to attack Jacob. So he's keeping those spaces so that at every moment, Jacob is making it more difficult for Esau to attack him. Are you with me? You see the plans at work. Jacob always about saving himself up until the point that all he has left is his family and kind of his personal possessions. And then he does the unthinkable. Only Jacob could do this. That night, Jacob got up, took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. That's a river that flows from the east into the Jordan. And after he sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions, Jacob remained behind by himself. Jacob is so concerned with his own safety, with his own life, he sends his family, his loved ones, into danger ahead of him. He sends them over first. What kind of a husband would do something like this? You know, just kind of funny story, when Nina and I were on our honeymoon, I decided to get her a surf lesson, and I'm the surfer in the family, so we went out with the instructor, and instead of being the bold man that would go first, we sent her out on that first wave, all right? And I sent her out, and it looked so great at first. She just kind of started moving, and that wave started going, but the waves were a little bit big, and this one was especially big, and then to my own kind of terror, I saw that wave just basically consume her, just crash over her, kind of shuttling her up onto the shore, and so I'm like, okay, I need to go do something about this. So I start to head in right when this beautiful wave comes along. So of course, I'm like, this is a lifetime opportunity. If you know surfing, this, you've got to do it. I catch that wave. I ride that wave. It was like heaven on earth. It was the best wave of my life. And I walk up on shore and there is my wife, scared and trembling and frustrated. And I think, I don't know what to do. So I just said, honey, did you see the amazing wave I just caught? I don't remember anything after that, like nothing. Jacob sends his family first. Jacob, to protect himself, self-absorbed, self-interested, sends his family first, and there he is alone, by himself, giving everything away, depleted and empty. No more plans. There's nothing else he can do. No more cards up his sleeve, no more tricks to play, which is when something happens that changes his life forever. Let's read it. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. We'll come back to who that is. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and humans and have overcome." And Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" As if he's saying, "You know who I really am." And then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. So we get to the story, and we realize that Jacob's life can basically be divided into two distinct chapters. His life before the fight and after the fight. His life before the limp and after the limp. And his life before the fight could basically be summarized kind of in this one basic idea, this one basic motivator. His life was really all about self-sufficiency. I mean, Jacob was part of this kind of ordained family. He was part of a God-ordained family. He talked to God. He prayed to God. He thought about God. But his life was motivated by his own strength, his own schemes, his own plan. He always had a way out. He always had a lie. He always had something that he could do. He believed in God, but he relied on himself. He believed in God. There's a God up there. I believe that. I can think about that. But when the challenges came, when difficulty came, he trusted in himself. And this is so true for so many folks in churches today. I just recently read an article about today's average Christian. And the article described the average Christian basically as someone who often comes to faith as a child, either through family or through a church experience. And the kind of concept of God kind of gets embedded into their worldview. But as they grow older, success and self-reliance become the basic motivators of their life, which basically means, other than the fact of that they have some kind of religious activity, their lives don't look any different than anyone else. In other words, it's possible to believe in God and to talk to God and to think that God's there and to go to church on Sunday or be part of a small group or to serve. It's possible to have a God concept and yet be totally self-sufficient. It's possible to believe that there is a God, and yet when difficulty comes or trouble comes or you face a challenge and suddenly the person you trust most is you. And that's Jacob. And that's a story. And that's when we find out in this moment in his life that God has something to say about that. That there's a deeper struggle at work beneath that. You know, the text says that a man shows up and picks a fight. And some traditions say that's an angel. Some traditions say that's God himself. But what we see here is that there's a struggle beneath the struggle. Jacob realizes in this moment his battle is not really with Esau. His battle is not with his uncle Laban. His battle is not with his family. His battle is not even with himself. His real struggle is with God. Later, the prophet Hosea would kind of express it this way. In the womb, Jacob grasped his brother's heel. As a man, he struggled with God. In other words, in his adult life, in his real life, all of his struggles, there was this struggle going on beneath that. So what are you facing right now? What challenge, what situation, what battle, what circumstance, what person? Maybe there's actually a struggle beneath that struggle. Maybe there's actually something else going on that's not about the circumstances. It's about who do you trust. It's about who's really in control. It's about who's really in charge of your life. And when the answer is you, God has a bone to pick. God is going to start a fight. Think about that. And notice the timing in Jacob's life. Jacob is alone. He's kind of depleted. He's empty. And at this point, it's like Jacob is an older man. He's like almost 100 years old. That's like John Ortberg kind of old, okay? And God shows up. God shows up. And not in a moment of tenderness, not in a moment of seeming compassion, though it actually is compassionate. He shows up and picks a fight. He shows up and wrestles with him. He shows up and he wounds him. God is in this in a whole different way. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. And so often, you see, we think of God as the thing that should come and take my pain or problem away. God is the one who should come and take my pain or problem away, almost like a drug. Many of you know the writing of Brené Brown. She's an amazing writer and researcher on vulnerability and shame. And she talks about going through a midlife crisis in her life. And in that, she decided to go back to church because the research says when you hit a midlife crisis, maybe you go back to church. But she was real nervous about it. She was like, you know, I don't really want to dress up and I'm not sure I want to meet new people and I don't want to go to a place with Jesus in the name. Maybe a saint's okay, but certainly not Jesus in the name. And then she goes back to church and she says she went back thinking, I was hoping I'd find a God that could just almost be like a drug that could take the pain away. But what she found was a God who was saying, maybe it's supposed to be hard. Maybe it's going to be hard. Maybe it's going to be a fight. Maybe it's going to be a battle. Maybe it's going to be a struggle. See, part of the reason why life is challenging is because redemption is hard. Love is hard. Faith is hard. And in this moment in Jacob's life, what he discovers is self-sufficiency has to die. His self-sufficiency has to go. And when that confronts you, when you're confronted with your self-sufficiency has to go, that is going to be a fight. Because somewhere deep inside, no matter how long you've been part of a church, I know this in my life, no matter how long I've been involved or have faith, there is a part of me that will not let go of my strength, of my will, of my smarts, of my ability to try to get through life on my own, of trusting myself. But self-sufficiency has to die. That's the decision. That's the moment. That's the question. That's what divides Jacob's life into these two chapters. And when Jacob realizes this, it's really amazing. This is when he actually starts to pray. This is when his conversations with God change drastically. But just kind of question, anyone ever feel kind of bored with prayer or just feel like, gosh, it's just not that interesting or I just don't have time to do it? It feels like, because I feel that way. A writer named Ben Patterson says that whenever you're bored with prayer, it's probably a sign that God is bored too. Because it means you're not talking to him. It means you're not real. It means you're not really at the real part of the struggle between you and him, between who's really in charge. But it's in this moment that Jacob, something comes out of Jacob that's entirely different. Listen to what Jacob says. It's an amazing line. He says, I will not let go of you unless you bless me. The man who's been holding on to everything else in his life, who's held on to his strength, his success, his reputation, his resume, now says, God, I will not let go of you unless you bless me. He finds himself now clinging to the one thing that he has, God. He has nothing else. It's so ironic. He sent all of his stuff across the river. He was there by himself. It was such a picture of what was always true in his life. He was always alone. He was always at risk. He was always vulnerable. And he was holding on to all that stuff, thinking, this is what's going to get me through. And now he's clinging to the one thing he has. And here's the good news. It's the only thing he needs. And it's God. And this is faith. This is faith. This is the heart of what Christian faith is all about. If you're new to church, if you're not sure what all this is about, this is at the core of it. Faith is not something that we achieve out of our strength. It's something that we discover when we have nothing else to hold on to. When the problems are too great, when the pain is too much, when the shame is too big, when our self-sufficiency just falls to the side and we've got nothing left, that's when faith can begin. When the only thing you can do is simply not let go. I love how I've once heard it put, I just love this line. It says this, you will never know that God is all you need until God is all you have. And how true this was for Jacob. You will never know that God is really all you need until God is all you have. And God is going to wrestle with us. He is going to battle with us. He will fight with us until we get to this place. And this is what the struggles of life, so many of them, are really all about. And I love how God responds to Jacob's prayer in this moment. He says, you will no longer be called Jacob, which means deceiver, manipulator, grabber. He says, you will be called Israel. It's a combination of two words, Israel, which means to persevere or hold on to, and El, which means God. In other words, the man who used to be the master manipulator now is the one who clings to God. The man who used to be the master of his own fate is now the one who holds desperately to God. And just think about it. God's people forever are defined by this. We are not the people of Abraham or the people of David. We are the people of Israel, the people who struggle. But hold on. The people who wrestle but cling to God as the only thing we have. That's who we are. That's our legacy. That's the church. We're not just here, you know, holding on to our stuff and then asking God to help us keep it. We're here. We're here because when it comes down to it, we actually have nothing else to hold on to. Nothing else to hold on to. And there's something even deeper at work in the story. Jacob doesn't just get a new name. he gets a limp. You notice that detail? It says, when the sun rose, Jacob walked away limping, wounded, humbled, vulnerable. In fact, he goes to meet his brother Esau, not in a show of strength or a show of force, not with a reputation or a resume, but limping, weak, and vulnerable. And you would think this would make his life worse. You would think this would be the end of him. But what's so amazing in the story is this is actually what saves him. The text says, when Esau saw Jacob limping to meet him, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. It's kind of interesting. Jacob thought he could buy or manipulate or kind of scheme his way through life. Isn't it interesting that the limp saved him? That vulnerability saved him. That his weakness saved him. And I have to admit, I don't like this part of the story. I don't like this part of the story. Because I don't want to limp. And I want you to see me limp in life. Just to kind of risk a moment of vulnerability, one of my great battles, struggles in life is with anxiety. I mean, just worry is one of my spiritual gifts. I can make coffee nervous, okay? And it's not just anxiety. It's this kind of anxiety mixed with vanity. It's kind of deeply rooted in what will this person think of me? What will you think of me? And will you think well of me? And I want you to think well of me. And I want you to think that I'm strong and I'm talented and I'm smart and I want to be someone that people would look up to. And it pains me so much when I realize that I'm not those things. And that I'm so imperfect, and I will worry about that. This past week, someone actually saw me at a meeting, and I was feeling tense, and they could tell I was just stressed and anxious. And in front of everyone, they said, "You're like a little ball of tension." And I just got so angry. I just kind of glared at this person thinking, "How dare you say that? How dare you talk about my limp? How dare you talk about my weakness?" But the truth is, this person was right. I was anxious. I was feeling insecure. And it was showing. And I wanted to hide it. I didn't want people to see it. In fact, I got angry when someone saw it. And I actually had to go back to this person and apologize because they were right. They don't work here anymore, but they were right about that. You know, here's the thing. God does something through our limps that he never does just through our strength. He works wonders through it. He redeems through it. He reconciles relationships through it. Because it's no longer about your self-sufficiency or your strength. It's about what he can do with you. I love how the Apostle Paul put it. I love these words. He said, "That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties and anxieties and struggles and self-doubt and body image. I delight in all that. For when I am weak, then I am strong." That's the confidence paradox. That's the heart of the struggle. And the question is for you, do you believe this? Are you willing to bet your life on this? Are you willing to let go and then hold on to God because of this? As the one thing you have and the only thing you need. You know, it's interesting in the story, Jacob names this place a very unique name. He calls it Peniel, which means the face of God, not a fight with God. He doesn't call it the place I fought God. He calls it the face of God, the place when I saw God, when I saw him. And I thought about that, like, what does he see? What does he really see? There's a writer named Frederick Buechner who describes what Jacob saw in a way that I just find amazing. So I want to read this to you. He writes, "The darkness has faded just enough so that for the first time, Jacob can dimly see his opponent's face. And what he sees is something more terrible than the face of death. It's the face of love. It is vast and strong, half ruined with suffering and fierce with joy. The face a man flees down all the darkness of his days until at last he cries out, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' Not a blessing that he can have now by the strength of his cunning or the force of his will, but now a blessing that he can have only as a gift. You see, power, success, happiness, as the world knows them, are his who will fight for them hard enough. But peace, love, and joy are only from God. And God is the enemy whom Jacob fought there by the river, of course, and whom in one way or another we all of us fight. God, the beloved enemy, our enemy because before giving us everything, he demands of us everything. Before giving us life, he demands our lives, ourselves, our wills, our treasure. That's what Jacob sees. That's what Jacob realizes. That the God that felt so much like an enemy that he struggled with, that was fighting over his self-sufficiency, was this God who had this incredible gift, a gift of himself. It's interesting, the story. A man wrestled with him until daybreak. 2,000 years ago, a man from heaven came again to wrestle with humanity, to fight with us and for us, and to give his life. And there on the cross, holding on to God, I will not let go unless you bless me. And 3 days later, God blessed him and raised him, and he rose so he could come and give you life. And that's going to be a struggle, you see. This redemption, this faith, this following God isn't just comfortable and easy. It's going to be a fight. It's going to be a struggle. It's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. But here's the thing. Success is not going to fix you. Surrender is. Success is not going to fix you. But surrender is. And so right now, in these few moments, I want to invite you to do that. In your way, in your words, in your heart. I want to make it real practical, real simple for you. I want to give you 4 words that you can say no matter what story you face or what situation you're in. God, I need you. Maybe you're in a moment in your marriage that's just painful or too much. God, I need you. Maybe you're struggling at work or with your career or in your financial life, and you're not sure what the future holds. That's not the struggle. The struggle is, God, I need you. Maybe life looks really good on the outside, and everyone thinks you're doing great, but inside there's this emptiness, there's this pain, there's this aloneness where self-sufficiency has run out of steam for you. You need 4 words. God, I need you. That's the battle. That's the fight. And it takes all of our will and all of our effort to let go of whatever else and hold on to him. But then let me ask you this question. What do you really got to lose? What's so good that you're holding on to? What's so great that you've got that isn't worth letting go and hanging on to the one thing that you really have, the thing that Jesus died for, and the one thing you really need, and that's him. So let's take a moment and talk to God and pray right now, if you would. If you close your eyes and bow your heads. God, the struggles we face are real. And oh, if we could only plan or outwit or have the strength to find our way through. And sometimes we do. But in the end, all we really have is you. In the end, at some point in life, we're going to be on one side of that river with everything else on the other side, alone and empty and desperate and not knowing what to hold on to. And that's when you show up. That's when you're there. That's when we find you. And not as an escape, not as a drug, not as a way to free us immediately from pain, but as a way to fight us over who's really in charge and who's in control. God, I need you. I don't stand up here because I have what it takes. I stand up here vulnerable and empty and scared But I will not let go. Right now, I just want to tell you, I will not let go. Right now, we, all of us in this room, just in our own way, are going to tell you right now, God, we're not going to let go of you. And in that, may we find the blessing of your strength and your power and your hope and your redemption, even where it hurts. God, we are grateful for the struggle. And in this amazing way, we're grateful for the struggle that the one who really won't let go is you. As you cling to us, even as we run, even as we hide. God, help us recognize our need for you and fall into your arms right now. We pray this in your name. Amen.